Hello and welcome to another episode of Office Hours with Alan, Nagera, Howard, and Harper. As always, I am your host, Jaleel Howard. Very excited to be back with our group. It's been a while since we've been able to get together. How is everyone doing?
Doing great.
Good.
Great to hear it. I've been very eager to finally sit down and record this episode because I find the topic of reopening schools fascinating for a number of different reasons, and I would just love to get you all's insight and keen analysis on a few different things. And one of the main things that has fascinated me during this time has been our government and government officials' response to the issue of reopening schools. So I would just first like to hear how you all or what your thoughts are on the state and federal government's response to the topic of reopening schools.
So I just signed on, and maybe I don't know if the rest of you have seen this, as a statement from researchers around the country on how to approach reopening schools. Have you all seen this one yet? I'll forward it to you all after this. But basically, it calls for, you know, some, I think, reasonable approaches that are based on science on how to think about reopening schools. You know, the importance of safety and but at the same time balancing the needs to be safe with the needs for kids to be learning, because we know that there are lots of kids out there who had no access at all during quarantine, and so, you know, in the absence of sound guidelines coming from the federal government, which there haven't been, or several states, to be fair, you know, it's been up to districts to figure this out on their own. And so this statement was issued in part to provide some, you know, evidence-based practices to school districts to consider.
Yeah, I think it's also, it's complicated, right? Because there are obviously the safety considerations that need to be taken into consideration. But there's also a lot of evidence that tells us that children, when schools are doing things right, benefit significantly from being in schools. And I think the mixed messages between the science on health and safety and the benefits of what comes out of children being in school have been not oftentimes understood by state officials. I wish there was much more of a consideration for these local and federal officials to talk to researchers who have done science, who are understanding, you know, the needs of students who have special needs, of what happens when they're not in schools. What happens to students who are experiencing homelessness, you know, when they're not in school? So it's a mixed bag. It's complicated, and I just think the void around leadership has not made the matter any easier.
Yeah, I'll just add that, like so many other aspects of the pandemic, this has been terribly mishandled by the federal government. You know, what we need in this moment of crisis is a coordinated national response, and we have been missing that. Here on the issue of reopening schools, much like we have with you know, other efforts to contain the virus or lack thereof, as a matter of fact.
And what strikes me is I definitely subscribe to all the points you brothers offered. At the same time, I'm thinking about a comment that Tyrone made: when schools work. And so as we are challenging, as we're confronting this challenge of reopening schools, we at the same time have to address the larger challenge of that harsh reality that in some instances under that normal circumstance when schools were open and running on their standard program, a good number of kids weren't being served. And weren't being, their needs weren't being addressed. They weren't receiving the kinds of an education that they deserve and need. And indeed, Pedro made reference to that on some level in his opening comments, just this whole notion of, anyway, I took away from it, this idea that, yeah, we have to open the schools, but this is an opportunity for us to rethink what those schools do as well and how to better accomplish the goals of schools. And just as I'm a little long-winded here, so I'll stop in just a minute, but I then link back to Sean's comment of failures in a kind of broader context of government and responses to COVID, but all of that, again, reminding us of this necessity to, I guess my sort of singular way of putting it is just to deal with the fact that there is unevenness and equity and access. And so as we are moving to go forward and reopen schools, hopefully we will at the same time be transforming the reality that had guided and had underpinned those schools before, such that there was just great inequity. So if we can somehow eliminate that as well, let's at least be mindful of it.
Yeah, Walter, I appreciate that you are calling us to think about the opportunity that we have in front of us as we consider reopening schools in some format. We ought not reopen them in an inequitable format, right? We have an opportunity here to correct some longstanding inequities. You know, frankly, I don't have children, but if I did, I would not want to return my children to, you know, an inequitable version of schooling that has become even more exacerbated by the inequities of the pandemic. As we talked about on a previous episode, you know, this pandemic has exposed numerous racial inequities in America. So, you know, any plan that is about reopening schools really has to pay attention to the inequities, the pre-pandemic inequities, as well as those that have been exacerbated throughout.
So I would just also add that I was wondering when it would happen that they, that they, and by they, I mean policymakers, realized you can't restart the economy without schools, right? That is that if you don't have, if schools aren't functional and operational, parents who have to work, and there are many people like that, they can't go to work if the kids aren't supervised. And so just that basic need, you know, what you're seeing, what's happening right now, wealthy people are able to get homeschooling arrangements set up and they're taking care of theirs. But there's such a critical need for societal commitment to education for kids, even just simply to make sure they're fed and they're safe. And that need is also right at the top of the list. So it's high priority. And it's just, you know, it's just a reminder, you know, that when we think about who's essential in this economy, it's so ironic that the lowest paid workers tend to be more essential than high paid workers, right? And don't have the luxury of working from home. And all of this is exposed.
And if I can add one more point to this, I think the other layer to this as well is the fact that even as we say, because of safety reasons, we will keep students in a remote situation, the data, at least here in LA, I'm sure each of you saw it, shows that Black and brown and poor kids were less likely to be connected. Black and brown and poor kids and foster youth were less likely to be online. So the whole inequity piece becomes even more of a challenge, because we still have not done, in my opinion, an adequate job of ensuring that the most vulnerable students get access to better access to opportunities to learn. To your point, Pedro, we know that the more affluent families are doing all kinds of creative things. They're creating learning pods, individualized tutoring, paying high-profile teachers to come in and do things both virtually and in person to ensure that those students don't fall behind. But yet still, those essential workers that you talked about, their children, are going to witness even further lack of connection and opportunities to learn.
And, you know, on that point of keeping children safe by keeping them away from the schools, again, we have to be mindful of the inequities. For some of my college students who've been online, they have been in situations and shared that home is not a safe place for them. Home is a very traumatic and unsustainable place for them. And if you think about that for a UCLA student at that age and with that ability to cope, just imagine the challenges that are confronting younger kids. And so there is some evidence that's showing higher rates of abuse and higher rates of just all kinds of problems that are associated with being in certain home situations. So just mind being mindful that we can't assume that that they're safe now. Just depends on their circumstances.
Yeah, Walter, I'd like to unpack that point a little bit more. And I'd like to gear this question directly towards Sean and Tyrone. So for you all as educators, what do you think the ramifications are for your students having to continue to learn online? I'm curious if your comfort level as instructors has increased and just how you would assess the overall quality of teaching and learning in this virtual setting as we're continuing forward with this.
Well, I want to point to something that Tyrone mentioned earlier, and there's language for it. It's what we're now calling digital dropouts, where, you know, there are a lot of students who are interested in learning, but their instructors are not, you know, teaching and really engaging, you know, culturally sustaining and creative ways online. And, you know, those kids are, you know, checking out and, you know, effectively they're not formally dropping out of school, but they are dropping out of the learning process. That is a real issue, and it is one that for sure is happening at higher rates among Black and Brown students. It's a thing that I'm definitely worried about. So, you know, we have to, as we think about, you know, some parts of the country will be returning fully to schools. Others will be doing, you know, some version of a hybrid approach, and some others will be fully online. You know, regardless, we have to upskill teachers and college professors on ways to teach much more dynamically so that we don't have, you know, students, you know, effectively dropping out digitally.
So I'm curious, Sean, what does that look like for you? I mean, because I know it was a struggle for me. It was hard to feel like you could connect with students virtually. It was hard to kind of pick up on some of the nuances from body language and the nonverbals. Has your teaching changed or looked different since we've been in this remote situation?
Yeah, so, you know, for me, like you and everybody else, we were catapulted into virtual instruction in the middle of March without any real advance notice. So I think that we all did the best we could for the remaining half of fall of spring semester or spring quarter. Now that I've had more of an opportunity to prepare for fall semester, and my university, USC, has done a phenomenal job through the Center for Excellence in Teaching and offering workshops and boot camps and all sorts of resources for faculty members who will be teaching online this fall. So we are now better prepared than we were in the spring. And I'm actually feeling much more confident. I'm also thinking much more creatively about my teaching. For example, over the weekend, Sean and I watched Free Meek, the series on Amazon about the just terrible incarceration of Meek Mill and his, you know, I think it was 10 or 11 year involvement in the criminal justice system. I'm now thinking about using Free Meek as a framework for my fall semester course on race and racism in education, because I think it provides such an instructive framework about systemic racism. I don't know that I would have seen a documentary series like that and, you know, used it to frame my course if it were being taught in a traditional format, you know, in a prior year.
You know, Sean, we have been over this past quarter with an honors seminar that I'm teaching, been making extensive and very intensive use of videos and movies as being at the center of our sort of analyses and discussions. So most recently, the Baldwin film, I Am Not Your Negro, where one of the students does the presentation and then our analysis and discussion is organized around it. I'm simply saying that I sign on to your point. And indeed, that's been a richer infusion in my teaching to have access to what are really extensive media sources out there. And by virtue of this remote setup, they're easier to incorporate in the course. Now, I suspect some younger folks had more of the talent beforehand, but for me in this platform, I'm now able just to integrate those kinds of materials and bring in online source material to support and engage the students and interact with what we're trying to accomplish in the learning. A caveat, though, is that I have a very small class. These are very small seminars. And I'm not quite sure how it will play out in a larger lecture. That is going to be another set of challenges.
So I'm curious if I could hear from you all. So as a student, I think one of the biggest things that I've missed out on doing virtual learning is the networking opportunity with professors. I took Pedro's course first quarter last year. I was able to have a conversation with Pedro, hear some of his stories, bounce ideas off of him and things like that. And I find I don't have that opportunity in virtual settings. And I'm just wondering what advice you would give for graduate students in terms of getting to know faculty while having to learn online.
So I think there's an important issue about that we have to, especially now that I'm a dean, think about. You know, with the quality of what we provide has to be worth what we're charging students, right? Otherwise, students are going to say, why am I spending this much money taking on this kind of debt for an online course that's not anything close to what I was expecting? And so, you know, I think a lot of it comes back to the instructors have to show a commitment to put investing in making sure that the time they spend with students is high quality, reaching out to individual students rather than leaving up to students to say, contact me if you need help, like kind of really being more proactive. So that requires, I mean, I think, you know, we didn't have a chance to prepare when it because it was so abrupt in the spring. But we do have a chance to prepare now. And I don't know how much faculty are availing themselves of the resources that are there. I know that I've talked to a lot of teachers in K-12, there have been very little emphasis on professional development for teachers so that the quality of what students receive when schools reopen is better than it was. But I think for the universities where people are paying tuition, this is a critical issue. And many universities, we're already seeing, will go out of business. If they continue to lose students, we will see many universities, especially private universities, that are tuition dependent, they won't be able to survive this period.
Yeah, you know, I think this is an important point because I know for me, when we were in person, I would have lots of one-off conversation with students before class, after class, during the breaks, and you kind of get to really formulate some relationships with some of the students that you interact with. And that's gone now in the virtual situation. So I think to all the points that have been made earlier, I think we as faculty have to do a better job of trying to create those one-on-one interactions in small seminars. But I would also encourage graduate students. I mean, I know I benefited in the spring quarter. I had at least half a dozen students who would still reach out to me and say, can we set up a one-on-one Zoom meeting? I'd love to talk more about, you know, my participation in your course, learn more about your work. I'd love to talk more about what I'm doing. So I would advise students, you still got to be proactive to reach out, to communicate. And I want to be clear, I'm not putting this solely on students. I think to Pedro's point, I think also faculty need to be willing to avail themselves as well. But because we're not in the typical times, I think grad students have to be a little bit more willing to step out and just create one-on-one time just to form that network that you spoke to.
Jaleel, I'll also add, as you know, Tyrone and I brought together 2,100 people from across the country a couple months ago for a national conversation on Black students' education and COVID-19. For that virtual event, we had a panelist who is a teacher here in LAUSD, Kiara Williams, and we selected her because she had been featured in the LA Times and elsewhere for her creative efforts to connect with each one of her students throughout the pandemic. She absolutely refused to allow COVID-19 to disrupt her relationships with her students or to have her students sort of fall out of the educational process. So she proactively and very creatively reached out to every one of her students. That is the thing that I am absolutely hoping and committed to doing this fall. You know, reaching out and connecting with all of them, you know, setting up some opportunities for, you know, some virtual hangouts together where we can hang out in small groups and students can ask me questions and process the material with me. You know, last spring, I DJed a dance party, a hip hop party for the students in my MBA course you know, I think that those are, you know, some things that we can do to help students feel like they still have access to their faculty members. I think that Pedro is exactly right that, you know, if it is just merely we're getting together once a week for instruction, that, you know, that's going to disappoint a lot of students and have them question, you know, why are they paying all of this money if they're not getting the other parts of the, you know, educational experience that are valuable to them.
Yeah, and I think what I'm hearing from all you, from all of you, is that we can't continue to act as if everything's normal when we know things are not normal. We need teachers and students to step outside of our normal roles to figure out what we need so that we can succeed. And now if I can slightly shift this conversation, and I'm gearing this specifically towards Walter and Pedro, because I know you all are both parents of school-aged children. And I'd just like to hear, what do you think about your children learning virtually indefinitely?
From my experience, and Pedro has an experience where he's living with his child. Mine, my son lives in Baltimore. But as we monitor his online experience, it is very unsatisfactory. And that is particularly a significant comment in the sense that we're paying a college tuition for his enrollment in Friends of School of Baltimore. And yet, even with that rich environment, resource-wise, in terms of the talented teachers there, the online option is, it's falling short. It just simply falls short. And so he's one who had been ahead of the curve considerably. And I worry that he's losing ground, or certainly at risk of losing ground.
Yeah, I think, you know, for my daughter, she's clearly a social person. She doesn't do well Zooming. There is evidence that there are a lot of introverts who actually like online learning and thrive in it. She's not one of those kids. She needs to be around her peers. She needs to be in more direct contact. So we have the resources to pay, we're looking into, can we get some kind of homeschooling arrangement with some other families to support our daughter during that period, or if the schools don't open. So that's where, again, the equity issues become, those with the means can do that, those without are left to what the public system offers. The other issue we haven't talked as much about is the mental health issues going on. And that affects kids, that's affecting the adults. And so people are not necessarily in the best psychological shape to engage in learning and teaching. And people are dealing with stress. So all of these are complicating factors that make this so unlike anything we've experienced before.
And speaking in a related sense on the situation of my son, Benjamin, he's an only child. And so that particularly exacerbates the isolation and the disconnect. It's one thing to have siblings around you. And it's an entirely different thing to be in a circumstance where you're the sole child in a household. And he too thrives off of those connections, perhaps particularly so since he is an only child. And there is a very real deficit, and I do just challenge and worry about the sort of social as well as mental health implications of that sense of isolation and disconnect.
And Pedro, you brought up the issue of equity, which made me think of something from earlier in this month. And Sean, you testified in front of Congress about the racial equity implications of reopening schools. And one of my biggest takeaways from hearing you speak was considerations for essential workers, such as custodial staff and maintenance workers, who are disproportionately folks of color. So I'm wondering, what steps do you think that districts as well as universities need to take to protect their essential staff, regardless of whether or not schools open up?
Yeah, they need to racialize their reopening plans. I've read now, I think I've become addicted to them, by the way. I keep reading these reopening plans, one after the other, both for K-12 school districts as well as post-secondary institutions, and they're completely raceless. I am afraid that there are going to be so many racial inequities that, you know, continue to be pronounced throughout this enduring pandemic and the reopening. So, you know, we ought not move forward in a raceless way. That's one thing. The other thing is that we got to make sure that we have the proper PPE cleaning supplies, contact tracing, and testing for essential workers, because those, as you noted, are in fact disproportionately Black and Latinx folks who will be clocking out from work and returning home to already vulnerable and devastated communities that have been disproportionately impacted by the virus. What a shame it would be if those folks got the virus at their jobs because they were deemed essential workers and they had to go back home and they were spreading it to, you know, members of their communities. I think that we have very serious educational responsibility to protect those workers with the proper PPE, contact tracing, and testing.
I think that is a very powerful point you make, Sean. And I muse about the fact that for the last few years at UCLA, for example, there's been this severe drop-off in terms of just fundamental cleanliness of a space, because it's been a budgetary kind of strategy. You just cut the cleaning force, so people can't even go into offices and empty trash cans, let alone wipe down services and do the kind of thing that you would expect. And being very clear that it's a burden that's placed on those low-level workers, in the sense that the workforce was being regularly, systematically reduced, whereas once, when I first got there, a worker would have no more than two floors that he or she was responsible for. And I am now in a moment last year where they had to do two buildings, you know, in their regular work hour, work shift. So it's just so many implications tied up in this new reality that we are going to have to struggle with. And one of those, by the way, is just this whole notion of value for dollar in terms of higher education. There were some arguing that the value for dollar wasn't there before, that people were really being charged more than they were receiving. And it then becomes even a more serious conversation to take up in this next moment, in the next era.
I want to pick up on Sean's point. I just think that's so critical. So last week I went to UCLA up to my office. I hadn't been there in some time, just to pick up some mail and check on some things. And I came across one of the custodial workers. I didn't even know what their schedule or setup was during this time, but she told me, she's a Black woman, she told me that they are on their same schedule, despite the fact that there is not the kind of consistent traffic that typically is on campus. But what I was struck by, she told me that she was working her same 6 to 2, 2:30 shift. But she has two kids. She has a 7-year-old and a 5-year-old. And she says she leaves the 7 and the 5-year-old at home alone because she has no one else to help her with childcare. And so I asked her, what did she do during the last quarter or semester when school was in place? And she said she pretty much laid out to them what they needed to do to figure out how to log on to their respective devices. She says she's talking to them 4, 5, 6 times a day just to check in on them. And it just makes me think about just these hard decisions, to Sean's point, that are being made by lots of essential workers every day, to have to leave 5 and 7-year-old children at home alone, to put them in the position to be responsible for their own learning. I asked her, you know, when she gets home, how was she able to assess what they've done? And she was very frank. She said, I feel like I'm overwhelmed. I feel like I'm not being the best mother to them in terms of their education because I can't be there to help support them. They've had a number of internet connection issues, she said, over the course of the time that they were there. But she said, the bottom line is, I need my job. I can't imagine not working. So it's these real, you know, just gut-wrenching decisions that folks are having to make on a day-in, day-out basis. I'm away from my children. I've got to put myself at risk. And she's probably not alone, to your point, Sean. There's probably countless numbers of other folks who are in those same situations, leaving young kids unattended. They're losing out on opportunities to learn, in addition to not having the kind of adult supervision that we know is desperately needed.
And sadly, Tyrone, in some ways, this is an extension of a reality that was with us before in terms of latchkey kids. You had to work, and yet the work schedules did not align with school, and the society was not investing in trying to create care situations and options for especially the children of the poor. I mean, those of us who have the resources, you paid for graduate students to pick them up and drop them off and for childcare and that sort of thing. So again, it just reminds us of a kind of a broader set of systemic inequities that had been with us and are now being exacerbated by these circumstances.
Tyrone, what you described undoubtedly impacts that woman's mental and emotional wellness. We have, in this conversation and in a previous episode, called for more attention to be placed on the mental and emotional needs of children. But now we should also be thinking about workers, right? Particularly those essential workers who have to make the difficult choices of leaving their children at home in the ways that you just described.
If I may, I'd like to pivot this conversation to the racial justice movement because they connect, right? That is that, so the pandemic exposed the racial inequities dramatically. We see who's getting sick. We see who's dying, disproportionately people of color. We also see the consequences of not opening school born disproportionately on the poorest people, disproportionately people of color. This speaks to the issue of structural racism that is pervasive in our society, but that I'm not sure, I'm a little concerned that this racial justice movement that's taken the country by storm is still focused largely on symbols. The symbols of the monuments, the symbols of white supremacy that permeate society, and of course, police brutality, the police killings. But these issues that we're discussing here, who has access to healthcare, who has access to school, who has access to resources, who's being laid off, who's faced with evictions now, and possibly losing your homes, these are structural issues that are of a different nature. And if this movement does not broaden its agenda to take on these issues, we're gonna find, we come out of this worse off than before because the agenda was too narrow. And I often see this mistake that we get very heated up about symbolic issues, but we kind of lose sight of these deeper structural issues like the one you described that custodian dealing with, which cut right to the quality of your life and whether or not you can function.
And you know, Pedro, that is a very powerful and profound point. And it goes to the fact that it's easier to deal with those symbolic changes. It's much easier to pull Silent Sam, the statue in the center of UNC's campus down, than it is to fundamentally revamp the sort of compensation and living circumstances of workers, lower level workers on that campus. And on this point of essential workers, it just has always frustrated me that this society does not value people who take care of children. It just doesn't. You look at the pay scales for preschool instructors, you look at the pay scales for teachers, and it is just such an upsetting and enraging kind of reality in the sense that where would be a better place to invest your resources than in the next generation? And yet we have functioned as a society in ways that are the exact opposite and contradiction of that. It just reminds you of Dr. King and other folks just pointing out that the true measure of a society is how it treats those people who are in the shadows and who are the most vulnerable.
I think if I can add on one final point to Walter and Pedro's point, so I think that the focus on police brutality is more sort of in people's faces and they see it and they react and respond, but it's the everyday kinds of examples that oftentimes just don't get the attention because, you know, I gave the example of the custodian, but there's so many layers and levels to that, right? So I would imagine that she probably is earning an hourly wage that's not even close to being a livable wage. I would imagine she probably, like many, spend 30, 40, in some cases, we see 50% of her income on rents. I would imagine that when you look at the quality of the school that she sends her children to, they probably aren't anywhere close to what they should be in terms of giving them an opportunity to come out of some of the circumstances that they're in. In some cases, you've got, and I know we all have seen this, many of these essential workers don't have their own transportation. So then you're talking about access to buses and transit lines. So this is the kind of everyday structural racism that doesn't jump out at people, but makes people's lives, Black and brown folks' lives, just incredibly difficult just to do the basics, to provide a roof over their head for my children, to provide food on the table for my children, to try to find a living wage. I mean, this is the insidious way that it just shapes the way that people's basic needs are not being met. But yet we still don't seem to have people who respond to that in ways that they respond to some of the other racial.
And Tyrone, that litany you just went through, if we place ourselves in the position of that mother, it is just a wonder that she doesn't lose her mind. Just all of what you ticked off, and with no kind of relief, even when she's home, it's her and the children. You know, there's not another partner. There's not someone sharing that responsibility. There's not necessarily someone to take care of her needs and deal with her sort of burdens. Now, shifting back to the point that Pedro made, and you know, I pointed out how symbolic change is easier. One thing that is encouraging about that racial justice movement with respect to police is the notion of redistributing the budgets for these cities and for, by association, the country. Not spending so much money in terms of policing, or, as I said, by association, the defense budget for the country, and reinvesting some of that money in other areas of need, in more essential areas of need, from my point of view, that have been neglected. So that is one encouraging piece of that conversation and movement. And by the way, that is the area where you're getting the greatest pushback.
Yeah, I would just like to also add on that I think a lot of our students are more aware of these inequities than we realize. I was speaking to one of my former students last week, and he said that he had seen something on the news about a private school that was building these pods for their students where they could learn in these individualized environments. And he said, Mr. Howard, we didn't have clean bathrooms all the time last year. And that equity issue right there, where he recognized that we don't always have paper towels in the bathroom, we don't always have soap in the bathroom, but they're about to get individualized learning pods. Our students are aware of this, and our students see this. And I think it's also important that as educators, we have these conversations with our students.
And Jalil, that simple quality of life fact about bathrooms and schools, you know, the research we were doing in terms of schools had it this, some of those young women, some of those students wouldn't go to the bathroom all day, because the bathrooms were not functional or they were not safe spaces. He didn't want to go in there because they were outside the coverage of the school security mechanism. So that is just a fundamental condition of life that students are being denied. How do you learn?
Yeah, let me ask a question to you on this one, Jalil, because one of the things I've heard teachers say in this moment is that they want to see students online, they want to see cameras on, they want to see them engaged. But there have been a number of students who are like, I'm not turning on my camera. You don't need to see in my house. You don't need to see my situation. You don't need to know my circumstances. Just be grateful for the fact that I even took the time out to log on this morning, given everything else that I might be dealing with. As a teacher, how would you have responded to that? Would you have required students to have cameras on, with students bright-eyed and bushy-tailed, ready to learn?
No, I think that's unfair, because I don't always feel wide-eyed and bushy-tailed, honestly. I think now more than ever, it is important that we are empathetic. And I think some students simply do not want us as teachers to see everything inside their home. Students may be embarrassed by what's inside their home. It may not be safe inside their home. Whatever it may be, they may not want us to see what's there. And I think as teachers, we must have students come as they are. That's one of the things I was taught my first year teaching, is welcome students as they are and accommodate for what they need. And I think that's the best thing we can do to help our students succeed right now.
Well, one of the things that I think is now different than it was in the spring is, if Zoom is the platform that we're using for teaching and learning, students can now put on a Zoom background and we don't have to look inside of their homes.
And I should just add, I mean, I'm sympathetic to the people who don't want to log on. Same time, you know, we can't just walking around in our pajamas all day, right? We got to step up. We got to show up. We got to make an effort. And if I'm organizing a lesson and I'm ready to teach, I need to see my students too. So, you know, I understand not everybody's going to be ready, but we should encourage people, take this seriously. We might be dealing with this for a while. So let's all show up and put our best foot forward. It's so easy when you're at home to just sit in your pajamas and lapse into lethargy. And that's not good for anybody either. So I think we got to find the balance between empathy and also accountability here.
And on the point of that balance, though, Pedro and Sean make good points. I think Sean's notion of using the background is very helpful. And just, again, all the complexities always show.
Now, I haven't mastered that technique yet, sir. You got to show
me. Yeah, but you know, when you use it draws down your bandwidth. And so it has to do with the sort of technological quality and strength of your situation. And Pedro, often the kids are ready and show up, but it's a house that's crowded and people walking behind you.
That's real.
You know, and you can't manage the adults in the house. So it is a complex set of challenges.
So I'm curious, let me ask each of you. So if you've got a seminar, and you've got a student, and that student never turns their camera on every week, does that pause? Does that give you pause? Does that give you concern?
I explicitly say to them, it is their choice. I explicitly say that to them, it is their choice. It's their choice, frankly, from my point of view, even when you have a middle-class home where you can go off into an isolated space. It's just a matter of control over your space and just feeling like you can make some decisions in this process. And honestly, I just want them online. I'm with Jaleel there. Just come to us, however you are, and we will take it from there.
I think, Tyrone, for me, this is where I would do what Kiara Williams did in the spring, the LAUSD teacher. I would reach out to the students whose cameras are never on to try to better understand what's happening. Is it in fact disengagement or is it something else? You know, like Walter, in the spring, I gave my MBA students the option of having their cameras on or off. And, you know, as each week progressed, I worked harder and harder to be more creative, more dynamic and engaging in my teaching. Nonetheless, more and more and more cameras were off. The further along we went. And that was frustrating to me. There was one week when I called out a student, you know, to speak, and he didn't speak. And I like called on him again. And then I called on him a third time. And it became clear to me, dude, you're not even here. Like, you just logged on to the thing and walked away. So there has to be some accountability for ensuring that people are actually showing up.
So, Sean, you kind of described my situation under normal circumstances when I was in lecture. And somebody was in the back doing Facebook.
But I think it's important, though. I want to build on Sean's point. And also, and this may not be popular for a lot of people, but Pedro raises a good point as well. So, yeah, we want folks to log on. But to me, at the graduate school level, there's a certain level of professionalism you still hope and want and need and expect. So I'm like with Pedro, I don't necessarily want to see you in your pajamas, right? I mean, at least put on a t-shirt. You can be in pajama bottoms and we don't ever have to know or see that, right? Or, you know, and this is my thing, and Jaleel knows how I feel about this, I don't know if I want to see the do-rag or the bonnet on when you're on the camera. It's like, come on, folks. I mean, give me a little bit more, like, I don't know. I don't want to play respectability politics here, but I still feel like the spaces that we create, while we want to be sensitive to people's learning environments at home, I don't want it to lax into something that's too comfortable, if that makes sense.
Tyrone, let me push back. So I'm actually in my pajamas right now, but I'm not wearing a do-rag. But let's say I were wearing a do-rag and I was like totally engaged. You know, if I'm home, I mean, you're in my space now, right? And if I wear my do-rag at home, shouldn't I have the right to do that? As long as I'm still being engaged and thoughtful in my participation in the course?
No, especially if it provides a level of comfort that you need to feel like I can learn and I'm here and I'm present.
So I know I'm sounding like the old guy now who says, get off my lawn, because maybe this is me. And so your point, Sean, is a good one. It's well taken that if you're engaged and you're participating, it shouldn't matter what you have on. But this is just my issue. I think we all have these issues. And for me, the do-rag, I have to admit, and Jaleel knows this because all my sons, they knew when they were younger, you're not going outside in a do-rag. You're not. I just think there's something to be said about how you represent yourself. And I got an issue with you being in that platform in a do-rag. I got to work on that, but that's just me being honest.
So, Tyrone, maybe your issue with the do-rag is not, in fact, conservatism, but instead fear for the ways that your boys would be treated by society if they were outside in the mall, absolutely, at school or somewhere else in a do-rag.
Yeah, I think the message we were always given was that you don't want to attract more attention to yourself. Being black boys in a predominantly white community is already enough attention that you receive just by virtue of being black. By adding that do-rag on top of your head, that is more attention that you need. That's more attention that you just do not need.
And not only attention, but you don't want to feed stereotypes. Mm-hmm. You know, you don't want to set yourself up, as Sean says, and as Tyrone was implying, so that you then can be pushed into a certain category that mobilizes the machinery of structural racism more excessively than it already operates.
Yes, and I appreciate you throwing me a lifeline, Sean, because I know I would have had all kind of folks who have been jumping all on me saying Tyrone is this conservative. And I think maybe that is the reality. There's a fear of, you know, we all got this message growing up that you had to be twice as good as other folks, as white folks, to be able to be successful. So you couldn't do, I see my white students who will come to class in holy jeans and tattered t-shirts and, you know, in all kinds of ways. And I think that's what white privilege affords them. Whereas I think that black folk are not given those same opportunities. We're more likely to be scrutinized. We're more likely to be dissected for what we say, how we say it, the way we're dressed, the way we present. And my dad just always made sure that whenever we were going to be in whatever was considered professional spaces, that you represent yourself in a way that you don't give folks any kind of additional reason to criticize you. So maybe that's part of it. And I think those are some of the conversations that we have to have with graduate students, that you're always on, you're always being looked at, you're always being, even in academic spaces, you're always being surveilled, you're always being watched. People are looking for some reason to find a chink in your armor, and just don't give them any more ammunition than they may already think that they have on.
I think you both make some very profound points, because you think about, and I've been observing now us for these 30, 40 years in acting, we disproportionately wear ties compared to our white male cat and colleagues. And we must, we must. That is the reality. Now, I chuckled to myself when Sean said he was in his PJs, because even then he's in his GQ PJs. He ain't just looking all crazy. He's looking stylish. So, you know, I would never have guessed they were PJs.
I'm turning my camera off now. I feel surveilled.
All right. So then for our last question real quick, I just want to touch on a few things we spoke about last episode. And I just think a lot of our conversation right now around schooling has to do with making these physically safe environments to protect teachers and students from the virus, which is obviously extremely important. But just a few weeks ago, we were talking about George Floyd and Breonna Taylor and trying to create these spaces in schools that root out anti-blackness and environments that work for black students. And I just want to know if you all feel like we've lost some of the momentum on the racial equity front, that we've been focusing so much on the virus that we forgot about creating these spaces and protecting our black students.
Jaleel, I'll simply say that it's the nature of this society is such that it is never comfortable with black people at the center and as the primary focus. And inevitably there is a kind of, and this is good and bad, you know, we'll start movements and those movements will expand, but too often, given the reality of anti-black racism, we end up being sort of drowned out, pushed aside, and so that is a concern for me.
Yeah, I share the concern too, but I think it goes back to our earlier part of our conversation around structural racism. So even if the shift is on COVID now in a bigger way than it was, say, when the issues around George Floyd and Breonna Taylor were happening, I think the levels of which even the pandemic are affecting Black folks are still real. We talked about the fact that we're disproportionately likely to be, you know, to get the virus, to die from the virus. If you look at the unemployment rates of Black folks compared to the general population in some cities, it's like twice that level, and it's gone up since then. You look at the number of Black folks just here in Los Angeles who are experiencing homelessness, and how homelessness rates have gone up because of the pandemic due to evictions. So even within the pandemic, if you peel back the layers and begin to racialize that, you see the ways in which these issues should still not be lost on us, that issues of racial inequity are just playing out in a multitude of ways, even if we look at the pandemic. So I think that it's imperative and it's essential for us to continue to raise these issues. And I know each of you brothers have been talking, Sean talking to Congress, the different podcasts we've all participated on. We cannot allow the racial realities of COVID to be lost in this moment, because folks will look at this in sort of this generalized way as if we're all affected somewhat the same by COVID. And we just know that that's not the reality.
And I hear the parallel and connect between your comment, which is right on, Tyrone, and Sean's earlier comments about these raceless strategies for dealing with reopening schools, for example. And for me, that's back to this whole issue again of this country being uncomfortable with confronting the reality of this history of anti-Blackness, this history of racial inequity that normalized Black people having the worst end of the stick wherever sort of environment and focus we're having, even if it's about just recreational options. The point and the reality was that we were supposed to have the least and the worst, or certainly it was normalized that we had such.
I am now left wondering, whose fault is it that we're not connecting all of these conversations? I'm also left wondering, why aren't people protesting the disproportionality of Black folks losing their lives to the virus? Why aren't people in the street protesting the structural inequities around schooling? Whose fault is that?
What do you think? Give us an answer.
You know, to be honest with you, like, I'm suddenly feeling personally implicated, you know, as this conversation has unfolded. It makes me wonder, are we as scholars doing enough to educate the public, not just the white public, about structural and systemic racism, but also our own people about, you know, the kinds of things that we really ought to be in the streets protesting? You know, on the one hand, I'm delighted that so many folks all around the world have taken to the streets to protest police brutality in Black communities. That's really important. But that's not the only place where anti-Blackness and systemic racism show up. Can we do more to advise those who are involved in the movement to understand its multiple dimensions beyond policing?
Sean, I think you're spot on. We certainly should take that responsibility, because that focus gets lost and it just does not get addressed in ways that are imperative. It's a very low standard for us to be in a situation where we protest and our goal is just to stop folks from murdering us publicly with impunity. And yet, from a survival point of view, that's certainly a place that one has to start. So it really is complicated. And as you said, there's a responsibility for a level of sophistication that we are discouraged in analysis of these inequities, that we are discouraged from adopting in this society. Because the society is very adept at just focusing on the high profile, the symbolic, the temporary in terms of solutions, when in fact there are these deep-seated structures and historical patterns and realities that that demand our attention and have to be incorporated. On the other side of the scale is you know, you're trying to deal with your small piece of it, and then if you put it all in that larger system of inequities, it almost becomes overwhelming at points.
You know, Sean, I share your concern that I may be implicated in this as well in terms of why we haven't done enough. And I think the folks who have pushed for police brutality as a focus would say to us, well, you need to do a better job of bringing attention to the topics that you care deeply about. We have been steady, we have been relentless, we have been persistent, we have not let up until the public understood that this was a real issue. But I would also add, what has helped in the police brutality fight is these real, as we all have seen over and over again, graphic images of Black folks losing their lives at the hands of law enforcement. And I wonder if, to some degree, we need to do something similar that captures what systemic racism looks like, just say within the education realm. If we can use the power of iPhones and videos to begin to have young people capture for us and describe to the general public, this is what we are subjected to on a day. I don't think the public knows a lot. And just like with police brutality, we knew about it for years, for decades. People told us, we saw loved ones and family members and friends who were subjected to it, but the general public said, no, that's not really happening. That's not taking place. Now, police wouldn't do that. They're here to protect and serve. And then Rodney King came up, you know, and then people were flabbergasted, shocked, not Black folk, because we had heard about that for years. I wonder how we capture our moment in education to show the kind of sort of real in-your-face neglect, brutal racism that happens to our children, and not only in K-12 space, but also in higher ed space. And this is perhaps where we lean on some folks who are, you know, these amazing minds we have who do documentaries, who capture these moments, and even Zoom. I'm seeing students now who are recording their Zoom sessions to just show the things that teachers are saying to them in this format. So some kind of way, I think we have to show to the public what we know has already been happening to Black and brown children in these learning spaces. But we need something that helps to galvanize folks around what happens in ways that should not be acceptable.
Tyrone, I think you make some really very powerful and accurate points there. I'm struck, though, by the Rodney King example. And this is a way of connecting into an element of willful ignorance and just determination to ignore these realities. Because you've got to remember that after Rodney King came the not guilty verdict with all of this video evidence, right? And similarly, as you said, there's a long history of documented brutality directed toward Black people by police, of inequities. And then there's similarly a parallel long history of no accountability, of juries coming together and just finding these folks not guilty when they were just blatantly so. And so that having been said, I just think too about inequities in the society. I say to my students, nobody wants to be poor because they understand what it's about. They understand in its very intimate sense that that is a brutalizing, dehumanizing, degrading reality in this society. And so that's where I'm back to willful ignorance, where people will pretend that they don't understand the consequences of inequity as they struggle and scrap and scrape to make sure that their kids don't end up in that situation and that they don't end up in that situation. But I like what you're saying, that we literally have to be creative and use alternative ways of just hammering away and publicizing these inequities so that they can't be denied credibly anyway. But, you know, I don't get me started. We've got a president who still is in denial and has a sizable following signing on to that nonsense of not dealing with these inequities.
I thank you all for your insights on this. And I think the thing I appreciate as a graduate student hearing you all speak is that looking at reopening schools broadly, you have all brought it back to yourselves and the different things that you can do. And I think that's something that we can all look at while we deal with this pandemic that we're dealing with, the racial injustice that we're dealing with, what is our part of this and what we can do. So I appreciate that message. Thank you all for your time as always. That's a wrap for us here at Office Hours. Make sure to subscribe, review, and rate our podcast wherever you stream your favorite podcast. And for more news and updates on Office Hours, follow us on Twitter at @OfficeHours_Ed. Once again, that's @OfficeHours_Ed. Thank you all for tuning in.